They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Joining us today, I have Ward Lucas. Ward is an amazing man. He's a professional, retired now. He's writing books, and it's been a while since he's been on. Ward, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Shu. I appreciate it.
You recently got an award. Tell
us about it. A few weeks ago. I was inducted into the Colorado Broadcast Pioneers Hall of Fame, which is funny because I didn't even know such a thing existed. But they had a very nice ceremony. There were about 100 people there, and I'm not sure how old the organization is, but they've got anywhere from 40 to 60 people who've been previously inducted, famous broadcasters from Colorado. What's really funny about it, the fact that I didn't know it was there, that happened to me in Seattle. I started in television investigative reporting in Seattle with Cairo TV, and I did a story many, many years ago. This would be back in the early 70s, on industrial arson, in which I hired an arsonist to burn down a business establishment. Well, it was a fictional establishment. It was all just discussions over the telephone with this arsonist.
Yeah.
And it was a great story. It was it went 3 weeks long. We had stories and interviews with several professional industrial arsonists. I didn't know such a thing existed, but I had seen the movie Save the Tiger with Jack Lemmon, where Lemmon tries to save his business by burning down his own business, which was failing. And this was happening, I discovered, all over the country and, of course, all over Seattle. But the boss gave me some dinner tickets one night, and he said, here, take your wife to dinner. Hmm. I said, what's this? And he said, just go. So my wife and I went to this dinner. It turned out there were probably 300 or 400 people in the room. We sat in the back and had no idea what was going on. At one point, somebody up on the stage called my name, Ward Lucas. And I had no idea what to do, and people around me were standing me up and sort of pushing me forward. And so I went forward onto the stage, and they handed me this big gold chunk of metal.
Wow.
I had, at that point, no idea what an Emmy Award was. I didn't have a TV growing up. I didn't listen to the radio. I didn't know such things as Emmy Awards were given out, but that's what this thing was. It was an Emmy.
Wow.
For this arson story. I mean, that shows how ignorant I have been all my life. I do these stories, but have no idea what else is going on in the world around me. But I started to walk down, and people started saying, speech, speech, speech. Well, I don't make speeches. Here I am a kid, and what, 26, 27 years old, I've got this chunk of something in my hands that I have no idea what it is, and they want me to give a speech. Embarrassing, humiliating moment in my life, but that was my first Emmy Award.
Your first. How many have you had?
Oh, I've been nominated, I think, 27, 28 times, and wow. I probably have picked up 11 or 12 Emmys.
How cool is that?
I know what they are now.
Now you know.
But they still sit in a cardboard box in the basement.
So when they say speech, now you know how to give a speech, right?
Right. You just say, thank you very much, and you sit down as quick as you can.
I want to thank my mother and my grandmother and my great-grand- Grand Uncle, and
I want to thank the Academy, and that's all I can think of to thank.
So, I don't know. You sometimes listen to these and you think, oh, wow, sit down and shut up. Take it and go.
Yeah, yeah. Award ceremonies are some of the most boring events in the world. You know, they should go on for 20 minutes and they go on 4 hours.
You know, it's really nice to be recognized, especially since you're being recognized by your peers.
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
That's really cool. That's really,
but it's
really
the height of arrogance to talk for 20 minutes about why you deserve that award. Nobody deserves an award. You really deserve to shut up and eat your meal and go home.
Eat your meal. Is the meal good usually, or is it rubbery chicken?
It's either chicken or steak.
We need something new. We need to we need to shake these things up.
Oh, you know, I've never been to a banquet with good old Vietnamese egg rolls.
Hey, there's an idea.
Those are delicious.
There's
That's
so
a banquet
much...
that would be great to go to.
There's so much out there that they could be doing, but it's always
Absolutely.
The same food. It's always the same food. You expect it, right? Oh, my gosh.
You know, it's funny. Years and years ago, I heard a woman speak at a conference on, and this is way off the subject, Sue. I hope you don't mind.
I don't mind. I you know what, Ward? I love your stories. I love your books. We're sick and tired of HOAs and their horrors. Let's have some fun today.
Well, this woman started something called Atlanta's Table. And Atlanta's Table was essentially an organization that would go around to restaurants after banquets and collect the food that had been the excess food, and all banquets in hotels and conferences, they overbilled by about 30% the amount of food that has to be cooked. And that 30% of the food ends up in the trash bins behind the hotel. So she had to get a law passed in Georgia to allow groups of people to go around and collect the banquet food to then distribute to the needy. So you have people who've never heard of lobster in their lives. They're eating steak and lobster delivered by one of the local organizations or trucks that goes around and picks up this banquet food. Well, I heard about this thing, and I thought, I wonder if we can start this in Colorado. And I began working on the idea and discovered that it is illegal in Colorado to redistribute food that has been cooked for a banquet. It had to go into the trash.
How ridiculous is that?
Pardon?
I said, how ridiculous is that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I got lobbying the state legislature, and I'm really not a lobbyist. That's not my thing, but I actually got a number of people involved in the effort. And we ended up starting the Rocky Mountain Food Bank. And part of the Rocky Mountain Food Bank is going around and collecting this banquet food and making sure it's not wasted, making sure it is available to the homeless. So, but to do this, I had to testify in front of the Colorado State Legislature to get the law changed. And I didn't do much work except for appearing in front of a committee once and talking about Atlanta's Table and how well that had worked out. But in Colorado now, a lot of the food comes from that goes to the shelters comes from these hotels, the 30% overage from all of their banquets.
So this is all good food that is
absolutely
expensive
good
food if they were to go and get it?
Well, we had to put together some refrigerated trucks. I think we had 6 or 8 trucks that would pick up the food and then take it to the food bank. But here is one of the greatest ideas that somebody in Atlanta thought of, and the idea has rocketed around the country. So here is probably the one country in the world where all of this banquet food is actually being used. There's no waste.
I think that's great. There's another story, nothing anywhere near as amazing as the banquet food. But there's the guy in Orlando, Florida,
mm-hmm.
who grew some
vegetables in his front yard because his backyard was too shady. And the city of Orlando went after him. And so he ended up creating such a stink that the city ended up with egg on its face, and they backed away from their nonsense. So he started this organization where they would go and they would actually work with people, especially the elderly, who had yards and couldn't garden in them. They would go in and they would plant vegetables and herbs and fruit and all kinds of stuff. And the owners would let them know what the owners wanted, and anything that was left over went to the shelters, and they had fresh vegetables.
Now, these obviously had to be non-HOA homeowners, right?
This was the city of Orlando.
Okay, but I'm talking about HOAs repeatedly tried to clamp down on anybody who has veggies in the front lawn.
Oh, I know, and yeah, they do that. I think, I'm not sure how many HOAs were involved, but I think the city backed away from the ban. Before you could say, well, it's the city, you know, the city won't let you do this, blah, blah, blah. Well, the city backed away from that. So now you have more of an argument that it is allowed by the city. So I don't know. But the thing is, there are people out there who are willing to put the work in to make sure that they can feed the homeless. They can feed the people who cannot afford to eat, instead of letting them run through garbage cans trying
to. Well, there is an arrogance in our country that transcends the bounds of anything reasonable, where they say, you can't do what you want to do with your own property because I don't want to have to look at it, or I don't want to have to answer questions about it. Your property has to look exactly like mine, and we all have to be at the same level. I'm not going to let you seem like more of a humanitarian than I am. And they use the regulations or the laws to stifle any dissent or any originality among homeowners, just through some sort of arrogance that happens in many times the HOA movement or HOA neighborhoods. And I see that time and time again, as you do.
Oh, yeah. What gives us the right to think that we can dictate what someone else is allowed to do? I mean, we're already mucking about with the words they use. We're mucking about with the colors they choose. We're mucking about with what they keep in their front yard. Did they get permission for that hose? Are they allowed to put up Christmas lights? Or are they going to offend someone, for heaven's sakes? And therefore, we can't do that.
Funny, there's a radio broadcaster here in the Denver area named Steve Kelly. Wonderful guy. He's been here for decades. But a couple of years ago, he called me and asked if I would do an interview about my book, Neighbors at War. And I said, sure, and went over to talk to him. He lived in a very exclusive neighborhood in southeast Denver. But I thought it was rather funny. It's a nice, nice neighborhood where his house is. But I saw a couple of violations, a lawn chair on our front porch, a hose the wrong color. So driving in the 8 or 10 or 12 blocks to his house, I took out a pad of paper and started writing down obvious HOA violations in this gorgeous neighborhood. But violations like a nail on a front door that should have been taken out when the Christmas wreath was taken down, and just little silly stuff, the wrong color hose, or too many cars parked in front, that sort of thing.
Dust on the mailbox.
Yes.
A cracked flower pot. People think I make this up. These are actual
stories. No, you're not making any of it up.
No,
but I
know.
Walked in to do the radio interview and immediately accused him of being in violation of something like 100 different HOA rules or potential HOA rules just by the fact that he hadn't made his lawn look exactly like all the other lawns.
Yeah.
I think the secret was that he had broken a leg or had hip surgery or something and was out of commission for 3 or 4 months. But during that time, all of this stuff began to build up. Now, I'm doing this just to mock a little bit because I doubt anybody ever cracked down on him. But it was a funny way to start off the radio show, being able to accuse him of being in violation of these hundreds of HOA statutes that had really badly impacted other homeowners around the country.
How could you do that?
I mean...
How could he do that? Just bring down the property values for a mile around his house?
You know what? I would pay a fortune to live next to Steve Kelly.
I would pay a fortune to live next to anyone who has a mind of their own.
Exactly. Well, he has a mind and a sense of humor and one of the greatest DJs and talk show hosts in Denver history.
So what did he say? Was he surprised? Was he shocked? Was he...
I don't know. You never know how to take... I hope he had a sense of humor about it. I'm sure he did.
Well, I think your book that you just talked about, Neighbors at War, that was the first book you came up with, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you.
And I think, well, you've been on, you've talked about it a couple of times. Anybody who wants to hear those interviews, you can go back to the archives. They're still there. You can listen to them.
And the book is still for sale.
And the book is still for sale, and it's still available, and you've got to read it. But here's the one that I remember was coming home and finding somebody had built a fence down the middle of your road.
Oh, yes.
I saw that picture and I just howled. I thought that was hysterical.
It wasn't hysterical for me at the time.
No, but
I'm not on HOA land. I am immediately adjacent to the famous or infamous Willowbrook Homeowners Association. And it's one of the most arrogant and disingenuous, lawsuit-happy homeowners associations in Colorado. And I ended up going into court for several years against them, but one of the things they did was they decided just to reclaim a section of property that may have been part of their section back during the Civil War, but they've never used that land. The land has always been used by the people on my side of the fence. So Willowbrook decided to go back and expand their territory, building the fence right down the section line, which went right down the middle of my gravel road. This is after 150 years of not using that land. I mean, they gave up the right to claim that land. So we had to go into court, and after a year or 2 years, the judge ruled that I was right. I could take the fence down and put my road back. Well, then Willowbrook went out with a surveyor and discovered that I was one chapstick's length off on where this road was.
Okay.
Originally, they had rebuilt the fence 16 feet into my property. So I put the fence back where the judge told me to. Well, they were out there with a surveyor, and literally the fence was off by the length of a chapstick. So I had to go down and rebuild this 300 or 400 or 500 yards of fence again back to a chapstick's length farther onto my road. So the whole thing was so ridiculous and expensive, and I started lots of rumors in this neighborhood, you know, Ward the bad guy, costing us all this money by being a jerk.
But what I loved also, I mean, I read the book when it first came out, so I haven't reread it, but I also remember that you went, must be somebody trying to call you.
Somebody is, but I'm ignoring him.
Yeah.
I'll get back to him.
That when you went there and you saw somebody working, I think it must have been from the HOA.
He was putting in the fence. Yeah, he had been hired by the HOA to put in the fence.
And you went, because it was a hot day, you went up to the house and got him a Coke or two.
Got him a couple of Cokes, went back.
Got him back.
And that he was told to watch out because I might shoot him.
Ah.
And no, I took him some Cokes.
And I thought that's funny, sitting there watching somebody build a fence in the middle of your road. Could you even get around there? Probably not.
No, I ended up having to go around the other way. It's about 3 or 4 miles to get around and come to the house the other direction. So, but no, what are you going to do? He's just a worker. He was told to watch out for me because I was crazy. And I showed him how crazy I was by taking him some Cokes.
So you took him a couple of Cokes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read that. I thought that was really funny. But the stories that you tell in that book are just really amazing. They're very funny. Some of them are very funny, like that one. But then you go into the very serious as well, and you talk a lot about the embezzlements.
Right.
And the foreclosures and the fines and all of that. So it's tempered, you know, you give us a little giggle and then you sort of punch us in the gut and say, all right, live in one of these things. This is what could happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, HOA life can be nightmarish. If you're not in the cookie cutter mold that the aristocracy wants to fit you into, then they're going to torment you. They're going to torment your kids. They're going to make your life absolutely miserable until you become one of the crowd. It's, to me, like one of the shots from the movie 1984, where your life is absolutely made miserable unless you are one face in the masses. And that's what many of these cookie-cutter HOAs do. They want everybody to be just alike. They don't want your politics to be different. They don't want you to talk about your politics. They want you to register as a certain political party. They don't particularly like diversity of opinion. And I'm not saying which party, because it varies from HOA to HOA. But they don't want you going to dinner with your next-door neighbor, because you might start talking about the HOA and what's wrong with it. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous how out of control some of these fascist neighborhoods have become.
I interviewed someone from, I think it was Pennsylvania, maybe somewhere on this coast, some time ago. He was a former judge who was handicapped, and he moved into this co-op. And he was telling me about the co-op. I would have been absolutely outraged. He was very sanguine about the whole thing. But do you know that they had rules that you could not get together with your neighbors and discuss anything to do with the HOA?
I'm not surprised.
You are not allowed to do that.
What's really surprising is the fact that you are not allowed in many HOAs to be handicapped. And people think, this is crazy, Ward, you're nuts. But in case after case and state after state, there are lawsuits where a handicapped person has been essentially regulated in such a way that he can't have handrails, he can't have a wheelchair ramp, he can't have any kind of architectural change that would change the flavor of a neighborhood. Well, all of this is illegal, blatantly illegal under federal law.
It is.
But you have to file suit. You have to spend the tens of thousands of dollars. Once in a while, you'll find an organization that will help you fight such monstrosities, such as the ACLU or various handicap agencies. But generally, that's only done once or twice until the money runs out. And there are hundreds of people in each state in that same position who've been discriminated against, who have to go to court, who have to spend their life savings to try to get these restrictions removed.
Ward, you know, there are two laws that I'm aware of, federal laws, that the feds actually enforce. One of them is fair housing, and the other is the Americans with Disabilities Act.
They sometimes enforce them.
They should enforce them.
They should enforce all of them, but they don't have the budget.
Well, they...
So they come up and do a demonstration case, and that's the last you hear of it, is one or two cases.
There are organizations that are funded by the government to enforce these. And what we need to do is make sure that they don't behave like a government because they're so inefficient, but actually get out there and do it. They don't know what they're doing a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They take forever. They are incredibly inefficient. They allow themselves to be bullied by the HOA industry. I've seen CAI attorneys go in and bully them and convince them that they don't have jurisdiction when clearly they do. Because, you see, the HOA is totally in charge of doing this. I mean, I've sat there in meetings and seen that happen and worked with the people, the inspectors who've done that. These laws are enforced by HUD, and I think we need to reach out to HUD and we should say, listen, you really and truly need to do a better job of doing this.
Well, there's the key, a better job. My college degree was in political science, and so we learned a lot about justice, but the one thing we learned that it's not justice if it's not swift. Well, where do you ever in our system see swift justice?
You don't. And here's the thing. There was a case, and I should write about it. It's kind of an old case. But somebody called me, and they were clearly being harassed. And I talked to them and recommended that they file a complaint, which they did. And I went to the hearing, and I talked to the inspector, and I sat there and I saw the attorney who represented the HOA, and he was a jackbooted thug. He was a young guy, just stomping up and down, saying it's so unfair. They're trying to make us defend the indefensible. How can you prove a negative? I mean, he was going on and on and on and on. And he finally bullied them into dropping it, saying, "You lack the jurisdiction to do this." Now, part of that law also says that while the investigation is ongoing, no one can interfere. If they do, there are built-in penalties. So he managed, this little jackbooted thug managed to convince the Human Resources Department to drop the case. The homeowners in this case were never notified until they got a threatening letter from the HOA attorney saying, hey, you know what? We've dropped the case. Now you owe us all this money. And you've got to do this, and you've got to do this, and laying down the law. And no, you don't. Because what he's doing is totally illegal. So we filed another complaint with the Human Resources Department, and we said, okay, you know, go after him. This guy violated the rules. You know what I was told? We don't go after attorneys. They may lose their licenses and won't be able to practice law again. I go, and the downside to that is, can you tell me? Well, of course they couldn't. But they have to, you know, the law should apply equally.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have, I mean, we've got a great system, but we don't have speed, and we don't have decency, and we don't have fairness. A lot of the things that would truly make this a free society are lost in the haze of legal bills and legal positions and positioning and roostering. We could improve our society in so many ways to bring justice about for those who can't afford to fight these multi-million-dollar fights against arrogance. So just because there's not enough money for us to fight the nonsense, we end up giving up, and the nonsense continues. And this happens in not just HOAs, but in professional corporations and in industries and in the halls of Congress and in the halls of CNN?
There are two organizations that I really admire greatly. There are probably more of them that I don't know about. But one of them is the Goldwater Institute in Arizona, and the other one is the Institute for Justice locally.
ILJ, yes. Good organization. Another one is, Stratton. They've been doing a lot of lawsuits into some of the FBI nonsense that was behind the FISA warrants, illegal FISA warrants that were used against the Trump campaign. Tom Fitton, I think, is the president.
Oh, yeah.
Great organization. Obviously, it remains it keeps its tax deductibility status because it is not a political organization. It's just, I think it's called the Institute for Justice or something like that.
No, the Institute for
Judicial Watch.
Judicial Watch, that's right.
Yes. And it's not a political organization, although a lot of people are accusing it of that, but it has tax-exempt status because it is not political. It is just trying to establish justice for all Americans by going after the illegal activities that are going on in some of our major government institutions. But there's an organization that bears watching. That's fascinating to see some of the things they've done.
Judicial Watch, yeah. But I've often thought that what we need to do is, if we could somehow, I don't know how to make the money, but if we could somehow start an organization, oversee the nonsense in HOAs. Now, IJ won't do it because they claim an HOA is a private, you know, they'll only go after the government.
Well, they are governments.
Well, they
HOAs,
are governments.
In every sense of the word, HOAs are governmental institutions.
I absolutely agree with you. But the fact is that it's a consensual government, and that's the difference. That's the difference they make. And I've talked to them because there were two of them. There was IJ and there was Defenders of Property that both started out in Washington at the same time. And I called both of them. Defenders of Property folded. They didn't make it. IJ did. But they said, no, they would not handle anything that's in an HOA because you agreed to the HOA. Got to get rid of that notion.
Yeah.
Nobody agrees to the harassment and the
abuse. Didn't agree. You know,
I've
been
either.
In three different HOAs and never once was given the chance to read all of the rules before I ended up with a property.
It wouldn't have made any difference.
In a piece of property, you have to make an instant judgment and grab it while the price is low.
The thing is,
there is no time to read all of the rules and restrictions and the CCRs. There's just no time if you're going to make a good investment decision.
But Ward, it doesn't matter. Even if you do read it all, it doesn't matter because you will find yourself in court defending something that's not in the CCNRs, that's not a restriction, but it comes under some really vague provision.
Well, that vague provision is called arrogance.
You go to court, and sometimes these judges just let it pass. It's like, oh, well, you know, the lot next door has a flagpole, and you violated changing the appearance of your front without permission, or the front of your house without permission. But, you know, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. They'll find a way. The industry wrote these things, and they wrote them vaguely enough that they could throw anything in any of the loopholes that they want to.
You strayed over into something that has been kind of a family, I don't know if it's a family joke or family tragedy, but my father was a lieutenant colonel in the Army in the last years of World War One. He was a tank commander and was involved in some of the stuff that was going on around Christmas of 1944. He was sent south by General Patton to take the town of Worms and then make his way up the race up the Tsar in the final months of the war in 1945. Well, a Nazi bazooka took out the top of his tank, and my father was critically wounded, taken prisoner by the Nazis, and the bazooka shell had hit his head, and he was critically in critical condition for months and months. But he was smuggled out to U.S. lines, after about, a week in captivity, less than a week, because the war was ending. This was March of 1945 when that happened. So I always thought that I would fly a flag at my home on the days that he was being held in captivity, 5 days in March. I put a flag on my door or someplace on the property. And I got nailed by the Willowbrook Homeowners Association. I got called by the president of the association. I'll name him Hatch Roten because he's no longer on this earth. But he said, you're flying a flag on an unapproved day. Well, the door to my house can't be seen from the road. It's invisible. If you want to see the front door of my house, you have to walk up onto the property. Well, certainly this guy walked up on the property, and he took account of the number of days of violations, and then he wanted $50 per day. Now, this was my first year in the HOA back in, 20 years ago. And I said, there's nothing in the regulations about flying flags on approved days. And he said, no, but we made a rule. It's not in the regs that you have, but we made a rule, and everybody knows it. Well, I didn't know it. So anyway, I had to give this man something like $250 to get him off my back. But today, I have a flagpole on my property that is outside the HOA but faces the HOA. I've got a flagpole, and I now fly my father's flag 356 days a year, 24 hours a day, and it is lighted.
I love it. I absolutely
in honor of my father.
There have been so many stories. There's an attorney in down in Richmond, and I actually managed to get him on 2020 a number of years ago. That was fun, but he's still working on this. That was a horrible story. Name is Richard Alton. Wouldn't let them. I'm not going to go into all the details, but really, truly, truly obnoxious. And then, of course, I had Larry Murphy on, and he had an unapproved object in his flower pot. Lived in a condo. Is an unapproved object, which was a little flag. And he was...
Oh, flags are obscene. You know that. American flag especially. They're so gaudy.
He was incensed that they called it an object. I think he almost lost his house. I think he got it back, but it was pretty awful. It was pretty, pretty awful.
Mm.
And what difference does it make?
Yes. Yes.
If you have a little flag in your flower pot, if you have a big flag, we want to regulate it because we want to make sure that it's safe and it's not going to hurt anyone.
Oh, I remember that story. Is that the little flag that was in the flower pot on the front porch?
Yes.
Yes, I remember that story.
Yes.
I remember that story. Shu, I don't know how much time you have left, but do I have time to talk about my latest book?
Please do. Yes, you do have time.
Fantastic.
We have about 15 minutes.
Oh, great. The next book has nothing to do about HOAs, but it's called Sometimes You Gotta Ride the Elephant. The Insanely Weird World of a TV Newsman. This book has taken off. I wrote these books just as a hobby, but these were some of the... It's an account of some of the wilder stories, undercover stories, in which I was involved over the years. One of them was my fight against the Church of Scientology. I'm one of the few that's ever won a great big battle against Scientology. Another chapter is... some of the crazy undercover stuff that I've done. I got into a big battle with the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News back in the 1983-1984 time period in which both newspapers were running fabricated stories. I mean, fabricated stories. And I went on the air and used the term fake news.
So it all started with you.
That term from me, that was my term, and I am owed commissions, I think, from Donald Trump for that phrase, because fake news is mine.
Let him know. Contact him and say, hey, Donald, guess what?
I copyrighted the term.
There you go. It's all mine.
It's a fun book. I think you've read it.
I have read it, and I loved every minute of it. And as I told you, you and I lived very different lives, very different backgrounds. But there was so much in that book that I still related to. And I think one of the big lessons for people who live in HOAs in that book is doing your homework and investigating, because so often you hear these stories that are so wild and nobody's bothered to sort of dot the I's, cross the T's, and link things together so they're not credible. But you've got so many examples of how you managed to put all of that together so that it was fail-proof. I mean, your stories...
Well, it's a fun book. And, you know, reporters, especially investigative reporters, have to be conscious of so many threats, so many dangerous situations, pit holes into which you can fall. And this book is really about the pit holes and how I escaped some pretty wild situations. And I've got all three of my books, Neighbors at War, Get This Mother Published, and Sometimes You Gotta Ride the Elephant, for sale on wardlucas.com.
I think I've read all of them. I love all of them. There's always something.
Well, I didn't
something.
Know I could write a book. This started out as an experiment. I spent my life writing two-minute stories for television news.
Yeah.
And a book was just beyond my comprehension. I didn't think I was capable. But I've won some awards for some of this, some of the material I've written, and I'm rather excited. I'm thinking I should have spent my life writing books instead of doing that stupid TV show.
So you enjoy writing the books, huh?
Well, it's a labor of love, and it's the most extreme punishment you can ever dish out on yourself.
Well, you know, when I write my promos once a week, that just little bit of what I write, it's agony. I just sit there and I go, should I start with this? Should I start with that? What should I say? How should I write it? You know.
Well, with a book, you start writing that, and you realize 3 nights have gone by, and you haven't been to bed.
And you
were unaware
writing.
Of the fact that you were awake all that time. And then you crash, and you have nightmares about all the stuff you didn't write. So you get up again, and you write for 3 or 4 days without going to bed. I didn't know that's what authors do, but I guess that's fairly common among them.
Oh, really?
So it's a new world that I'm learning about.
And do you enjoy writing it?
I enjoy telling stories, as you know. And I'm not sure that my stories impact anybody, but I look at the people that have impacted me over the years. George Orwell, he never knew that I read 1984 10 different times. Aldous Huxley, he never knew there would be a Ward Lucas someday that would read all of his books and enjoy them as much as I did. And I'm thinking to myself, 30 or 40 years from now, will somebody read this book, you know, long after I'm dead, and will they enjoy it? And will I even be aware that somebody has enjoyed it, because I've passed on to the great beyond?
I have enjoyed every one of them.
Thank you.
I have enjoyed, yeah, and there's something in it, I think, for everyone. You know, books, I think, have got to give you something beyond the entertainment value. I mean, but there's something relatable about everything. All of your stories.
Well, it's been a hoot, especially this last one. Sometimes you got to ride the elephant. And there is no meaning, you know, between elephant and the Republican Party currently in the White House. That was absolutely coincidental. So it's not a political book, but it's a very, I think, incisive book about the inside of the news media and what happens Oh, I've got a chapter called Stupid Newsroom Managers and Tear Gas. I have been sent over and over again into situations like World Series or the Broncos winning the Super Bowl, where a 500,000 people are out on the streets and the police are out there with tear gas. And I have had some horrible experiences being up close and personal when somebody was throwing tear gas out into the crowd. And some of those things are virtually not survivable, but there have been some angels in my life who have come in and protected me or helped me recover from a situation. But the one thing I say in this book, Stupid Manager, Newsroom Managers and Tear Gas, is that every TV manager deserves to be tear gassed, just so they can enjoy the experience, just so they know what they're sending their reporters out into. Because I doubt there's a TV manager anywhere in the country who has ever been gassed by the police department. It's a horrible experience.
You also talk about gas masks.
Well, that was another nasty thing.
Yeah, and then you had to go and buy your own.
Well, I would always go down to the Army surplus because they always had these Israeli gas masks for sale for, I don't know, $15 or $20. But in the middle of one of our big international sports teams' victories, OSHA came out with a regulation that we could no longer buy the Israeli gas masks. We had to buy the officially approved $200 gas mask. Not the $20 gas mask, but the $200 OSHA-approved one.
Wow.
Because the Israeli ones occasionally leak. Well, they do, and I've experienced that. But at the same time, for my TV station, which they did, to say, no gas masks, because we can't afford the OSHA-approved masks, was obnoxious, totally obnoxious. So at each one of these big, huge celebrations, knowing that I could no longer have the OSHA-approved masks, I would go down to the Army surplus store and buy 20 or 30 off the shelf and just hand a couple out to every crew member. Because, you know, if one doesn't work, throw it away. The next one might. But to have no masks when you go into a crowd riot situation is just obnoxious. It's hideous.
No, I agree with you. That's pretty bad.
So I would hand these things out by the dozen to my coworkers. But we couldn't tell the boss. It had to be our secret.
Why couldn't you tell the boss?
Because we weren't allowed to use them. You know, because they wouldn't buy the official $200 masks, we weren't supposed to have them at all.
So it was preferable for you to get gassed?
Yep.
And potentially killed?
Yep. Yep.
Than it was to get some kind of protection.
Exactly. And I never saw the sense in that. But I have a chapter about that, and I think I take a few knocks at my previous bosses.
You do. You do. I remember reading about it. And I remember sitting there thinking, whoa.
All of that's true.
How many of these people are still alive and do you think would read this? And would they read it and see how stupid they were?
Well, you know, I don't think they were stupid. All of this came down from corporate lawyers.
Was it Shakespeare said? First you kill all the lawyers. I think he had it right, huh?
Yeah, I think, TV newsrooms they're so politically correct and so heavily legislated by the legal teams. And, something like that gets going at the very top. The corporate people know there are going to be lawsuits if somebody gets gassed. So they say, well, you had the opportunity to buy the expensive $200 gas mask. Why didn't you? You know, and that's the argument they're going to use in court. But the station can't provide the $200 mask. So we would have to go out, you know, on the very low level of frontline reporters and buy our own secretly and just keep it quiet. But yeah, there's a whole chapter about that. I tear after several previous news directors and general managers in the book.
Oh, yeah.
I doubt I could get rehired at my station after what I've written and published.
Why not? They're afraid you'll go on the air and just talk about it?
Well, that's me. I was a loose cannon, always a loose cannon.
But
I won lots of awards over the years for being a loose cannon, so whatever.
But I bet you were polite.
You bet I was what?
I bet you were polite. That being a loose cannon, you weren't obnoxious.
Some people would say I was obnoxious. I think you know better than that, Shu.
I know better than that. I know better than that.
But I had fun. It was a good career. TV news is fantastic. It's an occupation that doesn't exist anymore because news media have changed so much. The web has essentially destroyed newspapers and television news point that kids today have no idea how good it was just 20 years ago.
But then you have people like me who come up and do a radio show without having any background in the news or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a podcast.
That's true. You can, but you don't have the mass appeal. Well, Drudge does, and Breitbart, and some of those who have a very, very big platform. But for you and me, our platforms are fairly small and fairly centralized around a specific objective of ours. And so we don't have the numbers of people that Drudge and Breitbart have.
That's true, but we have the people that count.
But we don't, and Breitbart and Drudge don't have reporters out on the street doing the day-to-day fisticuff kind of reporting that we used to do back in back when there really was an American news media.
Was that the fun part, the fisticuff part of news?
I missed that. Say that again.
I said, was that the fun part, the fisticuff kind of news?
Oh, yes. Well, the fun part was batting heads in a morning meeting. What kind of story are you going to do? What are you going to do? And brainstorming how your newscast was going to look that day. And this is right out of all the old movies from the 1900s, The Front Page some of the other stories. And the competition on the street for stories was so much fun because each reporter was in a position of trying to grab the story while outwitting and leading astray all the other reporters. One major story I had was, I don't know if you remember the story in Sometimes You Gotta Ride the Elephant, about the so-called cocaine kingpin.
Yes.
He was the most wanted federal fugitive of the decade.
Yes.
He ran a billion-dollar cocaine empire out of Stapleton Airport and Combs Aviation, the old Combs Aviation that worked out of the airport. He was vice president of Combs Aviation and had probably 200 drug smugglers under him. He sold airplanes to the drug smugglers, and they would bring in this stuff from South America.
Jeez.
And it would come through Denver. Well, the cops were after him for years and years and years, and he was essentially he was a huge figure in the drug cartels. All the arrest warrants were out. Nobody could find him. For over a year, the cocaine kingpin was the biggest federal fugitive that nobody could find. Well, I ended up talking to him one night. I had just gotten off the air after doing a story about him. And on the phone was this John Hernandez complaining about my story.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to him for a while, and I said, look, John, you're going to get shot. The cops could be bugging this phone right now. They're going to get you. Why don't you let me go with you tomorrow and turn yourself in? He said, only if you tell my story to the public. I said, okay, I'll meet with you. What do you want me to do? And he said, I'll call you, or I'll leave a message in the news at the front office the next morning. So I get the message the next morning, and the message says, be at a certain phone booth at 10 o'clock in the morning. If you're not there and you don't pick up the phone, I'm gone. He'll never talk to me again. So I made sure I was at this phone booth when the call came in. It was John Hernandez, and he said, go to the parking lot of a church, and he named this church in South Denver, Central Denver. Snowy day, so my photographer and I went down to this church, and we sat there for a while, and suddenly John Hernandez appears in my window. So we set up the interview. It was very cold outside, so we set up the interview inside the van. In fact, there's a picture of that interview going on inside the van. So I tell his story, and sure enough, he surrenders with me to the U.S. Marshal. All of the other newspapers and news reporters were furious that I had this guy into turning himself over. And day after day, I got bashed and bashed for harboring a federal fugitive. There was no such thing as harboring. I turned this guy over. But it was a very dramatic story, and that's the very inside of that story. I do that in a number of stories that became international and national in scope.
Ward, you're going to have to come back and finish telling us the stories because we are out of time.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Shu.
Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you so much for doing the show.
And you bet.
Please don't wait so long to come back.
Okay.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.